Parsha Korach begins with, in source number 1, the beginning of chapter 16, where Korach, son of Yitzhar, began a rebellion along with Datan and Aviram and On ben Pelet. They had a confrontation with Moshe along with 250 people, the children of Israel. And these 250 people are all referred to as men of rank of the community, representatives at the assembly, famous men, Anche Shem, Kuri Moe. These were the top people of the community. And they demonstrated against Moshe and Aaron and declared to them, "You have gone too far, Rav Lachem. All the people in the community are holy and God is with them. Ki kol hayda kulam kdoshim ubetocham Hashem. And therefore, umadua tinasu al kahal Hashem. Why are you setting yourselves above God's congregation? Everyone's holy." That was the claim that Korach made to Moshe and Aaron. So how come you're taking all these wonderful high positions, right? Aaron is the high priest and you're the leader. If the entire congregation is holy, so then everyone should have a fair share at these quote-unquote holy positions. It's not fair you're taking, you know, all the good stuff for you. So question number 1 we need to understand is, what exactly was motivating Korach? What was his argument with Moshe? And is it indeed a good argument? I mean, was he right? Or were there aspects of what he said that were indeed correct? That's what we have to examine. The second thing we need to examine is a very strange statement of the rabbis. This is in source number 3, where the Talmud teaches us, says Rabbi Levi, because Moshe announced the edict with the word sufficient, Rav Lachem, the edict was confirmed with the word sufficient, Rav Lacha, which means the following. When Moshe heard the Levi's and Korach's complaint, Moshe Rabbeinu responded with the word, Rav Lachem, you have enough. It's sufficient. You're asking for too much. Be happy that you're from the Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi. Rav Lachem, you have enough. Don't push too far. Because he used this phrase, Rav Lachem, you have enough, God used the exact same phrase when Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to enter the land of Israel, and he implored and pleaded with God, 515 prayers as a rabbi teach us, please allow me to enter the land. God responds, Rav Lacha, you have enough. Exact same phrase. Says the rabbi, why was the exact same phrase used? Because Moshe was a little bit harsh with them, Rav Lacha, you have enough. So God is using the same phrase, measure for measure, and say, you too have enough, Moshe. You don't need to enter the land. Let's take a look at 3b, Rabbi Miller Shabbat Shirim. What was the error in Moshe's phrase of rebuke that caused it to be thrown back at him before his death? What was wrong by saying, Rav Lachem, you have enough, that same word came to haunt him many years later in his life? Finally, the last thing we need to examine, then we can begin, is a very famous medrash. It's a medrash that can be understood on multiple levels. It's a medrash about what Korach did in order to encourage these people to join him, and how they scoffed at Moshe. It's wrote down in source number 2 of Rabbi Monk's book, The Call of Torah, a very famous medrash, where we know there's a law of tzitzis, a law of the four-cornered garment. We're in, at least in the times when we had this dye, this chilazon. Today we don't have it. But there would be on each corner white strings, white threads, which remind us of all the mitzvos, have this ability to remind us to have the fear of God. And on each corner there was one thread that was this tchelet, was this blue thread. And we know the blue color reminds us of the sea, and the sea reminds us of the sky, and the sky reminds us of the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of glory. So there was on each side one blue thread to remind us of holiness, remind us of God. So what did Korach do? He took these 250 men and dyed the entire garment tchelet, this blue color. And he came to Moshe and Aaron and said, let me ask you a question, a halacha question. If a garment is filled with this blue dye, look, our entire garment is blue, so are we reminded of heaven all over? Does it still need the strings that are blue as well? And Moshe answered what? Yes. And they laughed. And they said, give me a break. If the entire garment is blue, and the purpose is what? To remind you of heaven, so why do you need four threads when you have the entire garment? We need to understand what, and there are many levels of understanding this medrash. What does this medrash mean? What was Korach getting at, and what was the response of Moshe? So that's our challenge for the morning. Let's work with the first question. What was motivating Korach in his fight against Moshe Rabbeinu? What was at the core of it? So there's a wonderful idea that's brought in the Torah Semes, Rav Leiber LaEger, where he says the following. This is a very key concept. This is 4a. He says, Kevan shenivra ha'adam liyot holech. Man, people, by their very natures, are called holchim walkers. Ve'olem imadraga l'madraga, because people move from stage to stage. This is in contradistinction to angels who are called omdim, who stand. Right, they have a regular yishara, 1 foot. They don't move anywhere because angels don't have free will. So they just do what they're told to do. People who have free will are constantly moving forward. That's the concept of holchim. So if by nature we're holchim, im kein, therefore, madua lo yuchal gamhu lavo l'madragat hakuna. Why isn't it possible, if we're by nature holchim, people who move, why can't Korach become a Kohen? If we're trying to aspire to higher levels of holiness, so why would he be prevented from reaching this aspiration of being a priest? And continues Rav Leiber LaEger in another piece, and this is in 4b, and he says, "Umashach etzlo kol Yisrael," he was able to draw with him the entire people, and he was able to draw with him Rashes HaSanhedro, very important people. It wasn't a foreign drive that was driving the people. It's such a beautiful phrase. He drew them with the sweetness of holiness. And they too were drawn by this lure of that to be a holy person is a sweet thing. To aspire to great levels of closeness to God is a wonderful thing. They too wanted to experience this wonder, this beauty. And that's why they joined in this rebellion against Moshe, saying, we're all holy. We all want to aspire to high levels of holiness. Why are you preventing it from us? Why are you not allowing us to also be priests? Let's talk about this concept for a number of moments. This concept of drawing closer to God. What we would term in Hebrew is the word she'ifa, a ambition, a desire to become close to godliness. So the first premise that I think we need to understand is the premise of Rabbi Katz found in the book World Mask. And this is source number 5, where he says that every human experience is none other than the finite translation of an infinite idea. Human consciousness, while locked into a physical body, interprets deeper experience as a superficial one. Our work is to translate that superficial experience back into its source in depth. Let's give a practical example of what this means. And he says, and this is source 6, why do we long for home? It is a universal human experience that when one is away from home, and particularly from the home of one's youth, one longs to be back there. Continuing the underlined section, if all our experiences are none other than this worldly parallels of higher experience, what does this mean? The answer is that the neshama, the soul, is derived from a higher world. Its true place, its true home, is that world where it enjoyed indescribable closeness with the Creator. It is sent into this world immeasurably distant from that place of origin to reside in the body of a mortal being, but it never forgets at home. It forever longs with the most powerful longing to return. However, this depth remains subconscious. The neshama, the soul, longs for its real home in the spiritual realm, but the emotions read that longing as homesickness. After all, the realm of the origin is not visible from here. It has lost sight of it, and the mind cannot grasp it. So what he's saying, such a beautiful concept, is that when we experience different emotions and different feelings in the physical world, they're really a subconscious message that our spiritual world is trying to send us a signal. We don't have the tools, generally, to read what that neshama, what our soul is saying, so we interpret it on the external level. And homesickness is a perfect example. We've all experienced homesickness. We all want to long back for home. What it really is, on a spiritual level, it's the soul saying, I want to be back home. I want to be back from where I came from under the throne of glory. We interpret it as homesickness. moving, continuing with esteem in source number 8. And when we are home, we long to travel. For all the neshama, the soul's love of its origin, it nevertheless longs to move through this world, distant from its home. To enjoy the beauty of this world and to acquire its wealth, and the true wealth of mitzvot, of commandments, and perfection of character. The explicit conscious psyche experiences this deep stirring of the neshama as wanderlust, the longing to travel. Now, if we can understand this as our basis, we can then, I think, appreciate this concept of she'ifa. All of us understand what ambition and goal setting means, because all of us in our lives have goals. Whether it's goals on a professional level, where people want to move ahead professionally, they have their eye on a certain position in the company, in the group, whatever it is, and they're working their way through, and they know who to talk to and how to talk to it and who to deal with, because they know what their goal is. We have goals on a financial level as well. We have concept of saving for retirement, and when we retire, we want to travel the world, whatever it may be. We have a concept on a simple level, saving money for vacation, saving sick days, saving personal days to be able to take a vacation. We all understand this concept of having certain goals and working for those goals. What we need to understand is that this goal setting, which we do all the time on a on this outer world level, this external level, I see it all the time with students at EULA in particular, where you'll have students who will say, you know, I want to go into X profession, so therefore I need to get into X school, and I need to go this many years to this school, take this many summer courses in order that I can finish then I can get into this graduate school, and they have the whole, you know, next 10 years in their mind. You know, God has his own plans, but their next 10 years worked out in their head. The problem is, or the counterpart is, that as much as we plan physically, the question is, do we plan spiritually? Is there a counterpart within our lives of spiritual ambition, spiritual goals? We know where we want to land up, what homes we want, what cars we want, whatever it may be in the future. Do we have that same goal of where we want to land up after 120 years spiritually? And this is a beautiful essay by Rav Chaim Friedlander that sounds Sifte Chaim, which is on the second page, where he speaks about this concept of knowing where one is going to land is crucial in service of God. And he says that a person who wants to come closer to God but doesn't have this overall plan, so what the person will do is they'll change this aspect of their life, they'll change that aspect of their life, they'll work here, they'll work there, but they'll find they'll always be frustrated and never be successful. And the example that he gives, and it's an example we can relate to, and it's a powerful one. He says, let's take, for example, he brings this from Zundel, from Narvadik, this is source 14, in the Sifte Chaim. He says, imagine you ride on a train. And as you're riding on the train, someone taps you on the shoulder and says, guess what? You're riding in the wrong direction. Where you want to go is the other direction completely. So the person says, no problem. They get themselves up, and they turn their seat to the direction where they wanted to go. That's okay, I'm going the right direction. Very often in life, when we just change one or two things, that's exactly what we're doing. But it's not going to help us. What we need to do is get off the train and get into a train that's going in the right direction. And he says, the Sifte Chaim says, and this is so beautiful, he says, can you imagine, this is source 13, he says, can you imagine building a building and not having blueprints for what that building looks like? It would be a disaster. One big disaster. Could you imagine trying to plan anything? Plumbing, electricity, you can't plan anything. Because you build one room, you don't know how one room goes into another room, how one room is building atop another room. We can imagine in our head, you're never going to get anywhere. You're going to build and tear down, build and tear down. The first thing one does, if anyone's built anything, one knows this, is that you have to have an architectural plan. You have to have blueprints. And then you look at the blueprints and you say, okay, here I am on this point of the blueprints. This is where I'm building. This is where I know I need the electrical outlet. This is where I need to know where the plumbing is. This is where I need to know where the doorway is. This is where I need to know where the foundations is. This is where I need to have a harder structure, because it'll be a roof on top, whatever it may be. And he says, can you imagine if for a building we know we need to have a blueprint? Well, is this not the same of our lives? That we're, in a sense, building a building called growing, called taking the soul that was given to us and improving on it and developing it and bringing it to a higher level than was given to us, and we don't have a blueprint and we don't have a sense of where we want to go, we're living a world of disaster. It's okay, we knock a nail here, we knock a piece of wood there, but there's no sense, there's no order, there's no structure. First thing that one needs to do is to have a blueprint and a plan of where do I want to go as a spiritual person? How do I want to be? What's the model? What's my game plan? And if you have a game plan, so then you can move ahead. And it gives a deeper understanding, and this is sources 15 through 20, which we'll do outside, a deeper understanding of the law of Ben Sorer or Moreh. The law in the Torah that says if a child rebels, disrespects his parents, and is a glutton and sits all day and eats and drinks, so such a child should be killed. 13-year-old boy should be killed. And there are many, many details of what the child actually has to do. And the way it's generally understood is that this child, who is now robbing along the way, is killed because what he will become later in the future, which is he'll murder people, he'll do terrible things, so it's better to rid of him now. So explains the Ramban, Nachmanides, a whole different approach to this story. And he says, what was the problem of the Ben Sorer or Moreh? So says the Ramban, and this is found in source 15, he says, the child transgressed the commandments of to be holy to God. He transgressed the commandments of not clinging to God, because if you would be holy to God and cling to God, so then you would not be drinking and eating all day. So the obvious question we have to ask is, you expect from a 13-year-old boy to be clinging to God, to be holy to God? I mean, it's hard enough for us to be clinging to God and holy to God. So you're going to kill this 13-year-old boy because he's not on a level of being holy to God and clinging to God? Please! What's the point? To explain to Siftei Chaim, based on the Ramban, the point is the following. What does it mean he's killed because of the future? Because we look at him now and we say, does he have a blueprint for the future? Does he understand there's a concept of growing towards a goal which is to be holy? Does he understand there's a concept of growing toward a goal of clinging to God? We look at him now and we see by his behavior he has no interest in that whatsoever. He's disrespectful to his parents, he's eating and drinking all day, he has no vision of the future. That's what it means we kill him on the future, which means he doesn't have a sense of the future. But as we all know, and the Talmud tells us, the Ben Sorer Moreh never happened. There was never a boy that was killed. So if any of you got a little bit nervous, relax. No boy was ever killed. Why is it found in the Torah? Drush v'kabel schar, to learn from it. And one key lesson we learn from the Ben Sorer Moreh is the lesson that we just mentioned. If you don't have a blueprint in life, you don't have a goal of where you want to head, so then you're running into problems. That's the problem with this Ben Sorer Moreh. He didn't have a vision that he wanted to aspire. Okay, he may not be at that level. But if he's going to act this way, it shows you that there's no part in him that has a direction toward holiness. One final idea in the Siftei Chaim on the third page. Most of us are familiar with the famous book, Maseilas Yesharim, Path of the Just, by the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. The Path of the Just is a Mussar Sefer, a book of self-improvement, where the author, very famous, begins his book by saying that a person needs to know Ma chovato ba'alamo, what is one's obligation in this world? And continues the author and says, do you know what your obligation in this world is? He rak hadvei kutbo yisbarach, is clinging to God. So one opens this book and says, okay, what is my obligation in this world? It's to cling to God. And the Maseilas Yesharim, based on the Mishnah of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, the Braita really, list all these levels that you should reach until you get Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. So you read this book and you'll say to yourself, this isn't for me. Clinging to God? That's what I have to do in life? This is what you want from me? And immediately what are you going to do? Close the book. But that's the whole point. The point is, when you begin reading the book, know where you should aspire to. Chovato ba'alamo, what is our obligation in this world? It's to aspire to heights of dveikus to God, clinging to God. You might one night not be on that level right now, but if you're not going to have a vision of the future, if you're not going to have a blueprint of what your life should look like, of the end goal, the house should look like this, and we all have little models of what the house should look like, if you don't have that model in front of you of dveikus to God, of clinging to God, you can't get anywhere in life. That's why in his introduction he says, let me tell you, you need to know where you're going. You need to know what the model looks like. The model I'd like you to develop as a person, self-improvement, is as closeness to God. If you don't have it, close the book. You're not interested in it. But he goes one step further, L'sifte Chaim. And I like to do this line from 22 where the arrow is. He says, Kishe adam mitochnei mireshit darko at hamatara. If a person, before they begin the path, sets up what their goal is, yesh lo gam et ha-she'ifa la-gia la-matara. And this is key. If you have a vision, you have a goal, then you'll have a desire to reach that goal. And this is very important. Because we all know in our life, when we set up a goal, we get very anxious about it, very excited. I know I want to do something. So I work at it, and I work at it until I reach that thing. It could be as silly as Pesach cleaning, right? Rosh Chodesh Adar comes, we begin the Pesach cleaning. And as Pesach grows nearer and nearer, there's more anticipation, there's more excitement. Anytime you build up to anything, when you have a goal, when you have a vision, there's an excitement with it. If you're going to have a vision and a goal of what you should look like as a spiritual person, so then you're going to be excited about reaching that goal. If you don't have a vision, so then you're building a building that's going to be total haskeiros, total, it's going to be a total mess, and there's going to be no excitement about building. If you have the plans and you see the building being built and you're watching it step by step, then there's an excitement that comes with it. Now, there are two possibilities of what to do with this excitement. We have the blueprints. We know where we want to reach as a person. We have a sense of what type of person spiritually I want to become. So there are two ways I could take this excitement. One positive and one negative. And these two prototypes are found in Parshas Korach. And I'd like to examine them together because I think they have real ramifications for our life. The first is a negative one. What happens when you're so totally involved in trying to reach this goal and you're in love with God and you have this ambition, you can get carried away. And here's what happened. We know that these 250 important people who wanted to reach this level of priesthood, as we spoke about, so Moshe said, I'll put you to the test. Each person should bring an incense offering, and whoever God chooses, whoever offering he chooses, that will be the high priest. And if you're not chosen, you will die. You'll be burnt. Now, if 250 people are doing this, and Aaron, and you know only one person's going to live, so I don't know how many people would say, what? I want to try it out. The odds are really not for you. So the question Rav Schwab asked Zatzal in Mayan Beit HaShoiva is, what motivated the people to do this? Why did they do this test? So he says, in Source 25, he says, you need to understand the psyche of these people. V'chol chayehem hayu chayenes b'man uve'er uve'anei akavon. These people lived a life of miracle. They saw the manna that fell from heaven, they had the clouds of glory, they had the well. Harei barur shebaram bikirbam ava ad ma'od lakadosh baruch hu. They had a tremendous love for God. They had a tremendous desire to get close to God. And thanks, says Rav Schwab, very fascinating, when Korach's camp is referred to in the parasha, it's referred to as Mishkan Korach, which Mishkan we normally translate as a tabernacle, a place of holiness. They were very holy people. They wanted to come very much close to God. Their desire to come close to God reached the level of beyond the intellect, chutz la-seichel. And this, he says in Source 27, is what this medrash means on one level of this tchelet, this blue thread. Because as we saw, the tchelet resembles, the blue thread resembles the kiseh hakavod, the throne of glory. So they said, we're filled with blue, we're filled with love for God, we're filled with desire for God. Why do we need one thread that's going to remind us of the mitzvot when our whole being is close to the mitzvot? And therefore, let us do things that reflect our deep desire for God. Let's do what we feel we need to do to get close to God. And that was a mistake. They were so in love with God, they were so enraptured that they did what their hearts felt was the right thing in the service of God and not necessarily what God said is the right thing in service of God. moving to a Salvation, that found reflections of the Rav, source 28, he asks this question. He says, why does the halakha Jewish law refuse to give primacy to the emotions, to the inner feeling? Why does it not consider dveikut, religious fervor, more genuine and authentic experience than the outward performance of a mitzvah? Though we'll add that a mitzvah should have this dveikut, should have this inner spark. But why can't we serve God the way they want to serve God? I would like to show my love for God, so even though I might not be the one chosen, I want to bring this incense offering anyway. I want to do whatever I feel like to serve God. Even though it's wrong, I want to do this. Why can't we do that? Why can't I wake up this morning and say, God, I'm madly in love with you. And I'll find something in my house and I'll make a ceremony and I'll say, God, this is my way to show you, thank you to God for everything you've done for me. Why don't we do this? Why is there a prescribed, so to speak, almost a rigid formulation of law that makes us from that formulation have to have inner feeling instead of the other way around? Let's take the inner feeling and then show it to God. So he says there are three shortcomings. First, where the arrow is in 28, the religious emotion is volatile, ever-changing, and unstable, even with one individual. So today I'm going to do this, and tomorrow I'll do that, and the next day I'll do this. The mitzvah would continually have to be modified and at times nullified in favor of a new symbolic act that would correspond to the person's emotional state. Second, each person feels an emotion differently. Rituals would continually have to be reformulated to correspond to the feelings of different individuals at different times. What was inspiring to one individual might not affect another. No community service of God would be possible. And that's something beautiful, parenthetically, about Judaism. You could go to Hong Kong, you can go to Germany, you can go anywhere, and you walk into a synagogue, and you feel right at home. Because the service is exactly the same. Everywhere you go, and you can go in a time capsule. 100 years forward, 100 years backwards, and it's the same thing too. And there's a certain beauty in that. And third, we have no reliable gauge to differentiate secular types of response from the genuinely religious experience. We can't gauge that. And that's why he says in 30, to understand this concept of the blue thread, the tchelet, if one fails to conform to halachic norms, to religious norms, and instead of availing himself of common sense, substitutes a garment that is entirely blue, his response will be divested of its religious meaning and totally secular. And if there is a response at all, it will be mundane, hedonistic experience, aesthetic appreciation, but not a religious emotion. You know, if we take this on a very mundane, practical level, in terms of interpersonal relationships, we have this so often. Let's say we'll take a very simple example of it's somebody's spouse's birthday. So you decide you're going to make them a special dinner. And you spend all day making this Chinese chicken, which takes you hours to fry all the vegetables and to saute everything. You spend hours in the kitchen for this Chinese chicken. And then you present it to your spouse and say, happy birthday. I worked all day for this beautiful Chinese chicken. There's only one problem, and the problem is he hates Chinese. Now, who are you really doing it for? Yourself or him? Yourself. And this is the key with the problem with Korach is. And David Sachs, who some of you know, gave me the title for this year, and I think it's really on target, of spiritual ambition versus spiritual striving. This level where the 250 people were at is called spiritual ambition. It is derived from a real, genuine desire to grow spiritually, but it's an ambition rather than a striving in terms of it's very much rooted in self. What can I gain from it? How can I express my religious fervor to God, not what is it that God wants from me? And that's a big difference. But this is the key. The fire plans that were used to bring this incense were holy. They were brought in a holy service. So therefore, in Source 23, we're told in the beginning of the 17th chapter that Eleazar, the son of Aaron, was told to take these firebrands that had been sanctified, and he should beat them into a cover, make them plates of cover for the altar. And this is really symbolic of what the true service of God is. It's the concept of the altar. It's the concept of sacrifice. Let's move to the next page and take a look. We have another prototype of service to God in this week's parsha, in last week's parsha. And for me, there is, I think, the most dramatic verse in all of this week's parasha, in the section I'd like to deal with. And there's no shortage of drama in last week's parasha. The ground opening up, Aaron standing between the dead and the living with a ketoret to stop a plague, Moshe Rabbeinu falling, a lot of drama. But I would like to contend that this verse here tops them all off in drama. Let's take a look at the verse. It's a story. Let's do the background first. We're at the end of this whole, when this whole rebellion is quelled and everything is over, God says, let's know once and for all who indeed is chosen as the tribe of Levi. And he says, everyone should bring, every prince of each tribe should bring a staff, a stick, to the Ol Moed, to the tent of meeting, to the tabernacle, and each staff will have the tribe's name written on it, and whoever staff blossoms, flowers, that will be the staff, that will be the tribe that God has chosen to be the one who serves God. That's also a pretty dramatic section. That's not the pasuk I want to deal with. Now, what happens? We have, this is in also 17th chapter, 23rd verse, the next day when Moshe came to testimony 10, Aaron's staff representing the house of Levi had blossomed. And had given forth leaves and was now producing blossoms and almonds were ripening on it. Okay, that's very nice. That's also dramatic. Not what I want to deal with. Then, this is it. Listen carefully. Moshe brought all the staff out from before God and let all the Israelites see them to know for sure that what? That this is the one chosen by God is the one of Levi. This is it. Hold on tight. This is the powerful puzzle, or the end of it. Each man took his own staff. Isn't it amazing? Wow. That's powerful. Each man took his own staff. I know it's hard to just contain yourself, and this is really powerful. You don't agree with me. Let me explain. You'll agree with me soon, I promise you. Who cares if each man took his own staff? Why do we need to know that every prince took his own staff home? The whole phrase is what? It's extra. They saw that Levi's staff was chosen. Finished, Kenosa, that's it. Everyone goes home, and we understand that Levi is the chosen one. Why do we need to know that each man took his own staff? So, we have the Osnaim Torah, Rav Sarutskin, who says the following. He asks our question. Lama lakhu et hamatot hapshutim eish yaveit eish aleta. Why do they take these staffs home? So he says, we need to understand, this is sources 33 through 35, we need to understand why did they even give the staffs in the first place? He says, if you think about it, who would want to be the tribe of Levi? Okay, so you serve God, but you have to understand that the tribe of Levi did not have an inheritance in the land of Israel. They were completely dependent on the Jewish people to support them with tithes in order to survive. And if one looks carefully at Jewish history, there were plenty of times that they were lacking food. And they were literally starving for bread. Is this something that you would want to consciously say, I want to participate in this little competition to see who's going to be the one chosen to serve God, when you understand that if you are chosen, the ramifications of that are that you will be landless, so to speak, right, in the land of Israel, and be completely dependent for food. And yet, every single prince of every tribe said, you know what? I want to be part of this competition. Why? The same thing that was motivating those 250 men who brought the Ketoret. They loved God so much. Their love of God was so intense. If it means giving things up, I'm willing to do it, because I want to serve you, God. And there's nothing else that I would like than that deep desire to have that devotion to God, to be at service of God all day. They weren't chosen. But as Rav Sarutskin says in Oslam the Torah, what their staffs represented was their desire to be part of this competition. Their desire to be the servants of God. And taking their staff has two levels of meaning. One, for them, it represented bika'ava, with pride. And he brings down a medrash which says that these staffs remained in a history as part of that tribe. It's like, I guess you had a tribe museum. That staff was key exhibit number one when you walked in, because it represented to them their deep desire for the service of God. But yet on a deeper level, each man took his own staff represent that each man realized that they have their own staff, their own way of service of God, and that's what they're going to focus in on. If it's not going to be the tribe of lazy, then at least there'll be other ways where they can give of themselves to God, and they went home with that feeling, we will do what God wants, not what we want. Let's move to a practical example before I get esoteric again. This concept of doing what God wants, a certain level of the serious nefesh of giving up of self, is part of what living a spiritual life is all about. Let me give you a mundane example. There's a halacha, there's a Jewish law, very fascinating one, that says that while you're involved in a blessing, you should not be involved in your personal affairs. Let's reenact what happens in most homes, and you'll have to bear with me because of the tape recorder, it's hard to do the pantomime, so I'll have to do explaining as well. Shabbos afternoon, lunch. We're benching. We're saying the grace after meals. And you're still saying the grace after meals, and your spouse gets up to go. And this is what happens. And again, bear with me for the tape recorder. You say to him, you lift up one finger and you say, wait a second. You're not saying a word because you're still benching, but you say, wait a second. So now here begins the conversation. He says to you, do you want me to wait for you? And then again, you lift up your hand saying, yes, please wait for me. And he says, well, how long is it going to be? So you lift up all five fingers and you say, 5 minutes. Oh, it's 5 minutes. Oh, should I take one of the kids with me? And you go, you wave your hand, no, no, no. And you're still benching. Keep in mind, we're still benching here. And then he says, you sure we shouldn't take any of the kids? We say, well, and you point to one of, you have a whole conversation while you're still benching. This is what we're talking about, called self-sacrifice in the service of God. And it sounds like such a silly example, but such a practical example. If you're in the service of God, it's based on a pasuk of not walking with God, but carry the mikreh as chance. If you're involved in the service of God, then it takes a certain self-sacrifice not to be involved in service of self. Which means that if you are benching or davening to God, so then you will wait for this conversation with your husband until you finish benching anyway. Because you're really not having a conversation anyway, it's not making any sense. Let's give a second example. We know that after one uses the bathroom, there's a bracha of Asher Yatzah, a praise of God to be said. So again, what happens normally is that a person will start at the sink saying the Asher Yatzah, and will land up in the middle of the house by the time they're finished, have picked up four or five things along the way, put books back, whatever it may be, till one finishes. This is another example of if one's involved in the service of God, it could be anything. It could be eating a fruit and taking the apple and start saying the blessing, walking through the house till... If you're involved in doing something for God, then there's a certain self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice may not be the right word. There's a certain sense of holding self back to be involved in the service of God. And this is what Levi and the other tribes are willing to do on a grander level. We want to give up ourselves for God. In reality, and this is Rav Soloveitchik again in Yemezi Karon, sources 36 to 38, he says this in reality, getting back to our larger picture today of spiritual blueprint, when we talk about our spiritual vision, part of our spiritual vision of self is what we are put here in this world for. So one level of spiritual vision is to improve myself as an individual, that I'm a good person, I'm a kind person, I'm a person who's going to get closest to God through the mitzvot. Another level of our spiritual blueprint, which has to be part of our house, is how am I, with my unique capabilities and my unique talents, how am I serving God? What is it that God put me on this world for, that He put no one else on this world for? And am I fulfilling my abilities as who I am? If I don't have a blueprint of where I want to go and how I want to develop myself, so I'm just going to be floundering in the water for 120 years. So explain to Rav Soloveitchik, when we're talking about God measuring a person's ability to give in this world, what God looks for in this world is not so much how much one accomplishes, but how much effort of self did one put into this. And He says this so clearly, let's just see this inside, source 37, Hakdusha hazu, this holiness, nimdedet, is judged, lo lefi midat ha'isagim, not according to that which one accomplishes, ha'historim, on a historical level, elu lefi godel mesiras ha'nefesh shel hayochi. How much of yourself did you put into it? And that's what counts in life. A person should never judge themselves or anyone else in saying, this person has a greater role in history than I do, or this person is more important than I am. What counts in life is not how much you accomplish in life, but rather, from that which you were given, did you give your all in what you did? So looking at it from an objective level, and this is against Western philosophy totally. Western philosophy is the bigger the plaque on your door with the more letters after your name, that means you're an important person. That's reality. What Judaism says is that that's very nice and fine. But if a person was born brilliant and they had a connection to get into this firm or whatever it is, or how even they got there, it's not as important as how much effort did they put in to be who they were. And a person may have no names by their name and no plaque on a door, but they're putting their all into being who they are. They're far greater in God's eyes than this person with all these letters with a plaque on the door. And this explains, on this level, what the tchelet means, that sometimes you need to have one blue thread on each corner, which means at times you need to have one leader, one high priest. Because every person has their mission, has their job. We don't want just to have all garments blue, everyone is equal. That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for different jobs for different people, and each person needs to accomplish their job with their whole energy that they have. And that's why, to conclude this section in Source 40, Rabbi Leff in Outlooks and Insights states, Reb Zusha, a famous Hasidic Rebbe, was asked if he would accept the opportunity to switch places with Avraham Avinu, Abraham, our forefather. He replied, what would God gain? There would still be one Abraham and one Reb Zusha. Each individual has to aspire to achieve the maximum he can in his individual role and not to duplicate the role entrusted to another. There can only be one Kohen Gadol. Had Korach taken the attitude of Reb Zusha, it would not have made no difference to him whether it was Aaron or himself, and this is the key, as long as the duties of the office were performed in accord with God's will. It's not that I need to be the high priest, it's that God has a high priest. And that I have to be the best who I can be. Now, final section. If we understand that in order to build a house, you need to have a blueprint. In order to have a life spiritually, we need to have a spiritual blueprint. That leaves us with two final questions. One question is, how do you build this spiritual blueprint? What are the keys? What do we utilize to be able to build this picture? That's the question I don't want to deal with, because it's too big a question and too important a question. So let's deal with a more smaller question that comes from it. Once I have this spiritual blueprint, what do I do to begin to actualize on it? How do I begin building the building? How do I lay down the foundations and start building the building? And here, again, the Sifti Chaim of Chaim Friedlander in Source 42 states very simply. He says, "Shebishi'ifa ba'alma ein dai." To say I have a longing and a striving to come close to God, that's not enough. Ki ha'shoeif be'met l'ruchniyot. If you really strive for spiritual levels, ya'aseh gam ma'amatzim u'ma'asim kedei la'alot. L'hita'alot. You will do things in order to raise yourself up. He says, "Kigodel hashita shebeleiv ha'adam." The last line, "Kach yirbeh b'masim lasig et shifotav hatavot." There's going to be a correlation between how much ambition and desire you have, how much striving you have, with how much effort you're willing to put into it. And this is the key. And that is, you need to start building. To sit all day and dream and say, "I want to build a building. I want to build a building." And you're not doing anything for it, you're not going to get anywhere in life. You have to sit down and begin building the blocks. And that is through doing. Action. Right? The famous Rambam, the Bor in Source 43, Rav Walba and Ali Shur, where Maimonides says, is it better to give $1,000 to one person or $1,000 bills to 1,000 people? And the answer is the $1,000 bills. Why? Because each time you give a dollar, you're developing as a person. If I write out a check or give a dollar, so I've given myself once. If I give 100 pennies, so I've given 100 times of myself. And that's how I develop as a person. And he says in particular, the Michtam Eliyahu, Rav Dessler, it's the small things in life that we're judged on, not the big things in life. You know, when it comes to the big tests and the big mitzvot, we all do great. How are we on the small everyday level? The calling a friend who's sick, the helping the person out. It's the everyday small things in life. That's what we have to work on. And he says, this, on this level, we can understand what this blue thread is. It's the beautiful Rav Moshe, who says, if you think about it, there's something very strange. When the rabbis say that the blue thread reminds us of the sea, and the sea reminds us of the sky, and the sky reminds us of the throne of glory. So do me a favor. Find me a color that what? Reminds me of the throne of glory. Why do I need a thread that's going to remind me of? That's going to remind me of, which is going to remind me of. And why do we need one thread of blue? So he says very beautifully, you want to grow in life, you have to grow step by step. It has to remind you of the sea. The sea has to remind you of the sky has to remind you of God. The one thread. In life, you're not going to build a building overnight, right? Rome was not built in a day. It takes step by step. It takes the small actions of a person. And this is a beautiful idea we find by Abram and Sarah. It says that they were ba'im ba'yamim. They were coming of days. We take a look in Source 50, the Zohar comments that each day in a person's life carries with its own challenge and mission. What is to be accomplished today cannot be postponed to tomorrow, because tomorrow has its own set of things to do. In the normal course of events, people go through life with their spiritual calendars, quote-unquote, marred by countless days and hours that were wasted or even worse, misused. But the greatest people, such as Abraham and Sarah, come through life with all their days intact, all of them utilized properly and purposefully. This is the significance of the expression Va'im Bayamim. Literally, they came with days. They reached their old age with a rich harvest of days that truly mattered. We know, particularly now, it's the summertime, we always say to students and to children, don't waste your time, right? Utilize the summer well. You're not in a structured environment, use it well. And the answer is, the only way we can say that to a child is if we ourselves utilize our time well. If a child sees that the parent is able to take the time and utilizes it well, and that every day counts, and that every day matters, and at the end of each day you can say, I built another brick. I laid another piece on the floor. I know where I'm going, and I know that today I did something that improves myself as an individual and coming closer to God. My building is being built today. You don't need to tell your child not to waste time. The child sees it. It's a living reality. Let's get back to our original questions, and we'll close with one final idea. What was Korach's argument with Moshe? It was an argument that says, yes, we all are holy. And the argument was correct. We all are holy. But we need to understand where Korach went wrong is we are all holy in the service of God, not in the service of self. What Korach was really motivated by is, I want honor, I want glory, I want the priesthood. If he really felt it was for the service of God, he would have been satisfied that Aaron is the high priest. Let me become the best Levi I can become. And that's why, with the question we began with, why was Moshe, who said, Rav Lachem, sufficient, you have enough, why was that phrase thrown back at him when he wanted to enter the land? Because when he wanted to enter the land, he also wanted to go spiritually. He wanted to do the commandments in the land. And God said to him, Rav Lecha, you have enough. And he says, you know what? That was a bit harsh. Yes, Korach was misguided. But as the Sichos Musar points out, the 52, although his goal was wrong, but the desire was a good desire. You were too harsh by saying you have enough. Encourage the desire and channel it. Don't quash the desire. If a person has a spiritual desire to grow and come closer to God, say, that's tremendous, that's wonderful, Yashar Korach, great. Now realize that you are a special person. Let's develop who you are on the level that who you are. And that's why that was thrown back at him. You also have a spiritual desire. You quash their spiritual desire. In a sense, I'm stopping you as well, although clearly for other reasons. So that's what I think we've seen today. I think we've seen that we need to have a spiritual blueprint. We need to have that desire of Korach, which in its core was a good desire, to be holchim, to be walkers, to be movers. But we can only move and grow in terms of our service of God, like the story of the train, only if we know where we're going. If we're going in the wrong direction, just to switch our seat to face the correct direction is not going to help us. We We need to get off the train. We need to examine, what is it that I am doing in life that will make me a better person after 120 years, that I can come closer to God? And ask myself each day, am I coming closer to that? Am I building my building? Both on a soul level of coming closer to God, as well as in terms of my mission, am I giving my mesirus nefesh, am I giving in my all? Just like to close with a story that a young boy taught me, a very powerful lesson. It was my first teaching job. It was a Talmud Torah job. I had 12 fourth grade boys. And I once gave out an exercise to the young men. It came from some book where they took a Jewish star, and the kids were asked to write or draw your favorite Jewish symbols in each one of the triangles. And in the center triangle, write your most favorite, most special Jewish symbol. So kids drew a mezuzah and challah and a kiddush cup, whatever it may be, different symbols, a stucco box, charity box, different symbols, whatever they felt was their most important Jewish symbol. So I had one young man, his name was Stephen, I don't think I'll ever forget this, very powerful, who in the center of his triangle, what do you think he wrote or drew? So you would think it would be God, right? That would be pretty powerful, if he would write God, right? Exactly. He wrote in the center, myself. And this, I think, and this was a fourth grade boy, but this was a lesson that I learned from this young man. If you understand that the most important Jewish symbol in life is called yourself, and you're really invested in that concept called self as a Jewish symbol, so then you have the beginning of the desires to build that building and to complete the structure.